Welcome to The Optimal Path, a podcast about product decision-making brought to you by Maze. I'm your host, Ash Oliver, UX designer and design advocate. Great products are the result of great decisions. Decisions that deliver value for customers and the organization. In this podcast, you'll hear from designers, product managers, and researchers about the ideas informing decision-making across all aspects of product development. Today, I'm joined by Melanie Bassett, Senior User Experience Researcher at Spotify. Since completing her master's in human-computer interaction, Melanie has worked for large consumer tech companies, taught UX research at a university level, and actively writes and consults on topics within the field. I'm stoked to speak with you about UX research and ethics. Thanks so much for being here, Melanie.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's start by talking maybe broadly about responsibility and ethics in UX research. Maybe you can start by sharing what you consider to be a maybe good definition of ethics within this context.
Yeah, I think something to consider is like if you're doing a project and you're designing for specific solutions, or even like figuring out what this product might be, if you're kind of questioning, does it feel a bit sketchy? Then probably it is. So, I mean, it's good to question things, but I think if you're like questioning the ethical practice of it, then probably just don't do it. I think that's a good rule of thumb. Things like avoiding like dark patterns in design where you're just doing something for the sake of trying to get more people on your platform or to use your product, but without actually giving anything back to the human who's using it. I think that's like the definition of like not ethical or unethical, because then we get into, you know, a lot of issues like addiction to technology. And we've seen so much psychology research come out about the effects of social media use and, you know, desensitization sometimes to certain things if we're engaging in a lot of virtual environments and things like that. So I think, yeah, it's a very large topic, but I do think in general, like, again, what problem are you solving? And is it like bringing some kind of either enjoyment to someone's lives, enriching their lives in some way, or is it solving a problem and actually making people's lives better? I think that should be why we build technology and not for a company's own personal gain.
Well said, for sure. I have some questions later on about, you know, kind of that complexity or conundrum between perhaps what individually might be seen as unethical versus the business goal for, you know, driving engagement or retention or profit. I'm thinking as we're talking about, you know, kind of the responsibility for our participants and users, that the topic of ethics is usually intentionally considered during user research, or at least from my perspective as more of the design side. Like design kind of almost to our detriment may rely too much on research to kind of set the standards for ethics. But I guess my question is like, how can UX research and the practices of ethics be extended outside of just research so that it also permeates like our design decisions, do you think?
I think if there's any type of education that anyone who works in tech can do to understand more about ethics, even just ethics from like other disciplines that have been like quite well established. Like I come from a psychology background, and like there's a really robust and tried and true ethic board that all of your studies have to pass through in order to be able to execute them. So just being aware that that exists in some disciplines and some fields already, and then maybe even like learning about some of the unethical studies that have gone on could be a good way like into it and to understand why ethics is important, just to have that real world example. I think it really does come to, of course, individuals to educate themselves, but also the company that they're working for to provide that material and that information to them. So at companies I worked for, we have like how-to guides to like do proper research, to understand how to get proper consent, and to allow the participants a way to exit the study if they like to. And also doing like bias training, I think, is really helpful too. And being aware of like certain laws and regulations, like GDPR laws that exist in Europe, for example. So I don't know if there's like a clear answer to that. I think it is like a combination of it's the individual's responsibility, but also I think the organization or company that you work for should definitely have someone or a group of people or, you know, a working group that is focused on ethics and ethical design and design practices, which research definitely plays a role in that.
Yeah, I mean, it may go without saying, and you've just given some examples of standards or compliance things that have come into play to ensure that there's more of that like intentionality or guidelines around privacy and security. For example, when I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking back to the Facebook study in, I think, like 2014, where they showed people less positive content within their news feeds in order to assess if it influenced emotions, which I think is a pretty notable example. You were just describing are kind of like the micro and macro consequences. So it seems like there are factors to consider on the micro level of like individual consent or participant, you know, data that might be collected in an ethical way. Are there any other like factors that you see from a UX research perspective that could be overlooked or could cause harm if not considered?
Yeah, for sure. So I think some things to consider is like, again, starting with consent, so making sure that the participant like knows what they're getting themselves into and they know that they can get themselves out of it if they want and that they're not going to be like reprimanded or punished for doing so. And I think that kind of goes hand in hand with creating a safe space for the participant too. So if there is like a touchy subject, you obviously want them to feel, I don't know, like they can talk to you about it, but also like it's not necessarily your responsibility to like give them psychological advice or, you know, a therapy session. Because if you're not trained in that, then you definitely shouldn't do that. But just, you know, I think also being empathetic or showing the participant, like, I'm a human too, and so are you. So like, if this becomes a bit heavy or challenging, I can relate to you in some way. I've had participants like cry to me about design decisions that we made at a previous company of mine. And you know, that's a really difficult conversation to be in. But again, like the approach I had was just like being straight up with them, being like, yeah, I know this is really shitty what we did. We honestly like overlooked it and we're going to try and fix that. And I think if they just know, like, okay, I'm being heard, then that goes a long way. So that's kind of what I mean by like creating a safe space and like a human connection with them. And not just being robotic and be like, okay, thanks for your feedback. Even though you're crying, let's go to the next question because I need to get my insights.
I assume like UX researchers must be like really skilled in this way because it must be par for the course in order to establish that like rapport. To what extent do we really feel like we would get good substance of information from users if we didn't open a space for vulnerability maybe?
Yeah, for sure. And I think there are ways to like end an interview if you feel that it's getting a little too intense, too heavy and personal, maybe is just to thank the participant and say like, you know, we actually got a lot of information from you that we needed and we're okay to end it here. Also just like reminding them, like, if you don't want to continue, like you don't have to. So there's ways around that. I think, as you mentioned, like if you are a researcher and you've had experiences like that, like you're just going to get better at handling those situations over time. But I think back to your original question of like other things we can do to uphold like ethical standards with research is getting consent, helping them feel like they're in a safe human to human environment, and things like protecting their PII data. So making sure that when we do share outs and reports, we're not using personal information. And we've also told them in the consent forms and everything, like we are keeping your data private. So we should definitely uphold that promise. And I think like a couple things too I reflected on were like, we should pause research when needed. Like when I worked at Shopify, we put a pause on all research when COVID just happened. Cause we're like, okay, we're in the business of helping entrepreneurs and small businesses. And COVID is just like wreaking havoc on so many of their lives and their businesses. And you know, this is their livelihood. So again, it's like being human, right? And being like, if we were those merchants and those people, would we want Shopify knocking on our door and being like, hey, can you do this hour call for us? Probably not. So that's also, I think, something to consider.
That's such a good call out. I don't think I would have even, you know, necessarily considered that. Like, just thinking about the current affairs that might be impacting your users or participants and saying like, this might be a very pressing thing for us, but are we the only ones to stand to gain in this equation? That's really important.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it leaves like a bad vibe, I think, with them. If they're like, wow, this company really doesn't give a shit about me. I'm like, struggling right now and they're just wanting my feedback, that's another thing that I want to mention is you don't want people to feel like you're just taking and taking from them. It should be like give and take. So you should leave time at the end of the call to ask them if they have any questions for you, follow up with them when you can, if they ask for, you know, how is my feedback going to improve or impact some of the decisions you're making? And, you know, sometimes we can't always give that information back to them, but if we can point them to like similar studies, I think that's super important too, because I always think like, we never want people to feel like lab rats, like they're people, right? So it's like when you have relationships with people, it's a give and take. And I think it should be the same with your participants too.
Oh, huge. Yeah. I'm getting like kind of two things from you, like making them feel like they're part of it also can help, you know, kind of contribute towards their feeling of investment, you know, towards the thing that you're working on. But then also that there's like this brand extension that comes through in research. Like you could really deteriorate the brand sentiment if you leave an interaction through research being like, you know, really unethical or not well facilitated, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. I always tell the people that I do research with, like, we're not testing you, we're testing our product. So I think being very clear about that, like, this is why, like, if you've ever, I don't know, talk to me about research, I always share my like disdain with user testing as a name, because I'm like, it's that implies that you're testing people and testing users, but we're not ever doing that. We're testing a product. So yeah, just like calling that out before we start any type of research, I think is really important. And the last thing, which is more of like a personal reflection, is that because we work in this industry where we are having a lot of conversations with people, we are trying to like build relationships with people, it's important to, I think, recognize when like you're kind of like running out of gas and when you're starting to feel burnt out, or you're just like, today's not a good day for me. And how could that come out in an interview or come out in a call with someone who I'm trying to do research with? And, you know, that's true of like with your coworkers and your partner and your friends and your parents and whatever else. So I think if there's no exception here to being the same way when it comes to doing research. Again, we're all human. We all make mistakes. We all need help sometimes. And I think it's okay to like raise your hand and say like, I'm really not feeling good today. Do you mind taking this interview for me? Or even reaching out to that participant and saying like, something's come up, can we reschedule? Because chances are like rescheduling is going to be a much better outcome than just like powering through the interview and being completely drained and checked out.
Can you speak to any like examples of maybe ethical research principles or strategies from your work at Spotify? How do you ensure that the user research that you're doing is considered ethical?
Yeah, so I think some things that I like to remind people and even myself is that we are not our users. I work at Spotify and I use Spotify like all day long. So it's really easy to think, because it's so like one of those products that is so intertwined in our lives that we could be like, oh, like this is the way I use it. And because I'm using it so much, like I know best. And it's like, well, actually, I think we're the worst people to make decisions, if that makes sense, which like maybe sounds contradictory because we're the ones working there. But I mean, we should be making decisions based off of the feedback of the people like that are using Spotify who aren't us, right? So that's what I tried to share with my team, is like, we're so biased. We know the inner workings. We can't just, that's like another point that I have, is like, we can't make assumptions, because assumptions can actually be insults. And then the other two things would be like, what problem are we trying to solve? And then are we helping or are we inhibiting? Because like there are some products out there and companies where I feel like they share how they're doing so much good in the world and like that's their mission and blah, blah, blah. But then you see like how it is in practice and it's like not actually doing what they intended, and maybe they had good intentions or whatever, but then it's not how it's happening. So those are the things that I try and think about.
Yeah. So I wonder, I mean, these are really good like principles to kind of like lead by. How would you maybe put steps in place to build like an ethical research into practice? Are there like maybe steps that you could put in place that would help keep these philosophies like top of mind and engaged within the work across the entire team?
Yeah, so I think some of the things I mentioned earlier, which was like ensuring that there's consent, allowing participants to leave if they need to, sharing that it's not, we're not testing them, we're testing our products. I guess it's more of like a one-to-one to share with them, but also when we like build our vision docs or the product briefs, always having like some sections in there about what is the value that we're bringing to our customers or to our users. What's the cost of like not doing this? And what's the cost if we do it? So like, what could the negative effects be? And just trying to think those through before actually getting started on it. Something that I've done in the past is an assumption slam. This is when you like get all your assumptions out with your whole team. And it just provides this really nice space for everyone to talk about, you know, what they believe to be the best way forward and the best way to solve the problems that we're trying to solve. And then we actually go through those assumptions and map them on like how risky they are if we get them wrong and whether we actually know that those assumptions are true or not. And then that actually allows us to go a bit deeper into what kind of research do we need to do further to investigate this before we actually get going. So that's like a really good, like practical thing that people can do.
Yeah, assumption slam or assumption mapping sounds like a really practical and visible, tangible way to be able to, you know, kind of bring that out of the team. Do you see scenarios where that's done just as a research team, or is this extended through like design, for example, to kind of check those assumptions around like the actual solution?
Yeah, so when I've done it with my whole team. So that's like product, engineering, design, research, data, like anyone who's on the project. So I think that's super important, is to have the perspective of all the different disciplines and not just research, because, I mean, we could be privy to more of the findings than some of the other disciplines, and we don't want to just, you know, be within our own box and just think from like a researcher insights perspective, because it is super valuable to get other people's perspectives, especially from like the business side too. Because sometimes I think, at least for myself, I'm like always like cheerleading for, this is what the users want, this is what our customers want. But then there's like always, you know, well, we are a business and we need to consider the business needs as well. So it's good to get that reminder too.
Yeah, that actually leads me to one of my questions, because I think in some cases, like researchers are striving for like ethical research practices, but they might work in companies that prioritize unethical products or experiences, or are at the crossroads of making an unethical decision. So how do we balance the decision to increase company profits while being ethically mindful of users?
Yeah, that's a good question. If I was like working on a project that I felt like very strongly against, and I was like, this is like ridiculous, I would probably like speak up and say something, or just be like, I'm not going to work on this project because that's not where I want my energy to be focused. Because, you know, sometimes we have the privilege to pick and choose what we work on and where we work. And sometimes we don't. And that can be a really tricky situation if you are in the situation where you're like, I just have to do this job because of whatever reason. Then it's just a matter of reminding yourself that maybe this is just a means to an end, and eventually you'll get out of it and you'll be able to choose what kind of companies and causes you want to work toward and work for. Another thing is to try and use your skill set to convince maybe the person who's making the decision to not make ethical decisions. And I mean, from an insights point of view, like we have a lot of data and a lot of qualitative feedback too that we can use to be like, you know, we tested this out and this is the feedback we're getting and it's very negative. And, you know, you could do different projecting analyses or whatever to see like, what is the cost of shipping this and it tanking? And I think then if like the CEO or the product lead or whoever it is that's like making that decision can see the potential impact of moving forward with this shitty, unethical decision, then maybe they'll second guess it if they see that the dollars are not going up, but actually going down.
Absolutely. I love the ways in which we're taking our skills and experiences and utilizing them inside the business, being able to use that as persuasive on behalf of the user and behalf of what we're hired to do. But I think, yeah, like you said, there's kind of two words that every designer or researcher or anyone in product really should be comfortable saying, and that's no and why. I think just being able to think critically. I think everyone on a UX team has the potential to play a role in collecting and analyzing like product and UX research data. For example, you know, designers might need to conduct their own usability tests, or PMs and developers might be like analyzing interview information. Obviously, UX researchers are driving a lot of this practice overall. So how do you scale the ethical practices into conducting UX research if you're not a UX researcher? So it's not just maybe about like scaling the work and activities of UX research, but actually the values that guide it.
It's a good question. I think like making those values readily accessible to anyone is something that is important. Like if there's like a how-to guide for non-researchers, that would be super helpful. And also if you can offer training, like we offer training, and at Shopify we had a similar thing too, where, you know, it's definitely encouraged for designers to do a lot of their own like tactical research. So if they're doing usability or concept testing or things like that, we want them to feel empowered and, you know, that's part of their skill set as well. But of course we recognize that it's not always something you learn when you're a designer. So I think recognizing that and just having a team that is devoted and willing to educate them on what it means to conduct research in an ethical way goes a long way. And sometimes that could be a lot of work. That could be like one person's job at a company is to go through this training with people who are not researchers and to make sure that everyone's doing anti-bias training and things like that. But I think if you want to be an ethical company, then it's worth putting those options out there for your employees, or not even an option, making it mandatory. And then I think also just making sure that these other disciplines know that although we want them to do their own research, and that's great if they do it, that a researcher is always available for them if they need to talk through something or if they're not sure about something. And also like if there is an ops team of some kind, trying to make it easy so that, you know, if they need to sign or send an NDA or if they need to send a consent form, the way to do that is not super difficult, because there could be like a whole process that could be like just adding a lot of friction that's unnecessary. So yeah, it seems like a lot of like organizational and operational things need to happen. But again, I think it is important to consider that if you want to have a company that is like doing things right.
Definitely would be a big oversight, especially in the industry where we're seeing a lot of conversation in regards to scaling user research and how this is really a collaborative and team sport. It's not just all relegated to UX researchers. It would definitely be, I think, a big blind spot for teams to just scale the documentation or the architecture or operations around just fulfilling the activities and miss the whole, you know, kind of guiding principles behind it. So having that documentation to be able to interact with and incorporate, I guess, ensures that that ethics part is a part of any of the research, not just the researchers that are doing it.
Yeah. And I think like, I think about, you know, onboarding to companies too. And if they have that as part of their like onboarding, whether you're a designer, researcher, product person, whatever it might be, and just having a section in onboarding that like, this is how we talk to our customers, and this is the kind of company we want to be when it comes to ethics and how we treat and interact with our the people that use our products, I think is super important. Not just like, here's your first day, here's like a nice sticker for your laptop and a hoodie, and now go wild. I would say like one thing that you could do to encourage it maybe is to like, rather than have someone go through the training on their own, which could be kind of grueling and, you know, boring or whatever, is to just do like shadowing, like shadow a researcher so you can see how they integrate ethics into their work. That could be another way too, rather than just like, again, here's some documentation, go read it, and like hopefully you do it. I think like as researchers too, it is part of our job to like educate people about this kind of things. We need to bring it up and we need to showcase why it's important too. Like at a company I worked for before, we did something where we encouraged people to come out and do like visits with our customers. So it wasn't necessarily like a research activity. It was just getting that like that one-to-one with our customers. And I think that made it really exciting because it wasn't like you didn't have any expectation that you'd have to come out of the visit and, you know, have another report to make. So it was just like, you can go and meet these people. And I think once you get that FaceTime, then you give a shit more about the ethics because you're like, oh, this person is so lovely. I wouldn't want to, you know, build something for them that sucks or that isn't useful or is being detrimental to their lives in some way. If you just think about like your parents are using these products, your grandparents are using them, your nieces and nephews, your kids, like everyone is using them. And I think when you just take a step back and think about that for a second, then maybe that would be enough to be like, yeah, I wouldn't want my, you know, 4-year-old niece to be using this product that's making her feel like shit because she's not pretty enough or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the more you describe this, it's clear to me that like empathy is so interconnected within driving ethics. Like you ultimately like can't have maybe one without the other.
Yeah, I think doing those types of things like going face to face or like reading support tickets, if that's something you have access to, if there's like any kind of like ongoing survey that your company is involved in, like an affinity survey or a sentiment survey, something like that, like reading those like open-ended comments, going on like Reddit even sometimes can be really interesting and seeing people's comments there. Like yesterday was when Spotify went down. I was on Instagram and I follow this, I think it was Vice News, and they had commented about it. And there were so many comments from people being like, oh, my run was just interrupted. Like, I just had to pull over on the side of the road to like log back in. This ruined my dinner. And it's just like, it's so interesting to hear because that's like real feedback. You know, like I'm not there. There's no researcher there. There's no research guide. That's like the real shit. So
unabridged in the comments.
Yeah. If you go to those like public forums, they're so interesting and you can just do that on your free time. And it's not like anyone is expecting you to come up with any new piece of work from just reading those things.
Absolutely. Getting that like in context exposure definitely can be illuminating. I'm wondering if there's like a heuristic for ethical UX research. Like how can we measure ethical maturity within UX research as a whole? And like maybe if there are like elements of ethically mature user research practice.
Yeah, I feel like most companies that I've worked at that I feel like do have a really high standard when it comes to ethics, they're providing anti-bias training to all their employees, which is super interesting too. You know, I studied psychology, so I'm really interested in how people think and how we do things and our biases and things like that. So when I did that, I was like, wow, this is so cool to see what my biases are. Like you think that you know and you're aware of it, but then you do something like that and you're like, holy shit, like I have some work to do.
Yeah. The unknown unknowns are like, you know, the most scary.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like, you know, if you do that too, I would just say like preface it with, don't be too hard on yourself if you think the results that you get are worse than you thought, because a lot of the biases we have are because of, you know, who we are, where we grew up and those types of things that are innate and sometimes can take a lot of training and practice to change. So yeah, just something to keep in mind. It doesn't mean you're a horrible, bad person. It just goes to show how deeply ingrained our biases are. And I think that's super interesting. Another thing is to have some kind of like, if there is a research operations team at the company, definitely on the top of their list is ethics and making sure that we have things like consent forms and NDAs. And we're able to also recruit people in a representative way. So we're not just only doing research with, you know, white, English speaking, North American people. Because I think a part of being unethical is just always sampling and talking to the same people and only getting the perspective of one type of person. So I think being able to, again, like recruit in a more representative way is something that I think companies who are pretty mature in this area would have those resources.
Yeah, the diversity element would definitely, in my mind, stand out as a representation of how ethical, not just in the sampling of, you know, diverse participants, but also the diversity in the makeup of the team too. That's the other extension of making these decisions and concluding and synthesizing, is like, how diverse is the people that are assuming all of this information or evaluating it? So are there any questions that maybe designers or researchers should be asking themselves in order to uphold these things?
Yeah, so I think what we just talked about is, how can I include a representative sample in my research is definitely one thing to consider. If there's a language barrier problem, or physically you can't like go to a part of the world where you'd like to gather feedback from, you know, we have a lot of remote tools now. We have ways that you can work with translators. There's research agencies out there that specialize in this type of thing. So there's ways around that, and not just, again, sticking to your own kind, which is really important. I think another question that I like to ask myself is like, if I ask a personal question, and I see this all the time in like surveys and in interview scripts, especially with, you know, junior researchers or people who aren't researchers. And like, again, this is not to fault them. It's just, you learn this as you go. But seeing things like, what's your age? Where do you live? What's your occupation? And I'm like, is that really important to the product that we're building and to the decisions that we're going to be making? Because like, I always would give the example to, in the course that I taught back in Toronto, was like, put yourself in someone else's shoes. Like, we're going through COVID right now. If you said like, what do you do for work? It could be like, I just got laid off because of COVID. And now I'm like struggling to have enough money to feed my kids and to make my rent. And you know, and then it just like snowballs into this whole really difficult and challenging and heavy conversation for that participant. So I'm like, would there be a change in our decision making if, you know, if they worked as a teacher versus they worked as a bus driver or whatever? Like, probably won't make a difference. So just don't even ask those questions.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's one of the first things, at least that I've seen, is when people approach like user research, they typically like feed in all of these like demographic questions without even thinking that it may be completely unrelated or do more harm.
Yeah. Like another one that I share with the students that I taught was, because they would often ask like, what's your address? I'm like, what? That's so specific. But also like, where do you live? And I'm thinking like, you know, imagine you're like, oh, I live in this neighborhood, and it's like kind of run down, and I'm embarrassed to say that I live there. And then I like get on a call with this researcher who works at Google, who's making like six figures and has this beautiful backdrop. And, you know, there's this whole like power dynamic that gets introduced. What I mentioned at the beginning of the call was like to create an environment where they feel like this is a safe space and we're equals here, right? Like, although you're driving the conversation, we're still human beings.
That's hugely important. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I don't think we give maybe enough thought about what happens once we have that answer too, right? And like what that could look like from the other side.
Yeah, because then there's like, you know, there's speaking about biases and things too. There are like experimenter biases and participant biases too, where they might be like, oh, like I, you know, now that you know this information about me, I'm going to answer in a way that makes me feel more superior or whatever it might be, right? So there's all these different things at play that could happen by asking these questions that really bring no value, or they won't change your product decisions whatsoever. So I always say, like, if you really need those questions, ask them in a questionnaire that happens beforehand, or can you get them from your data scientist? But also, again, if it's not going to make any changes to the product, then just forget about it. We don't need to know that information.
Totally. Yeah. Thinking critically is definitely a theme throughout this, as you've been, you know, describing it. And I think that's really important, especially as we get like templates are really helpful and checklists are really helpful, but like making sure that we don't just templatize this thinking, that we actually think critically about the context, the scenario, the human dynamics that are involved, as you've described.
100%. I think another thing too I wanted to mention, which is another question we could ask ourselves, is can this question or conversation or research be triggering to someone in some way? And if so, how am I prepared to react to that? An example I could think about, and I'll use the context of Spotify, because that's where I'm currently working, is like, I asked someone about their personal playlist, and you know, that's a personal playlist, so it probably has some sentimental value. And then maybe it's the playlist was made for like this couple's like anniversary or their honeymoon or something. And then maybe the spouse passed away or they broke up, and then they're flooded with all these memories of that person. And then, you know, there's a lot happening there now. And it's just like, you thought maybe you're just walking into a conversation talking about how they curate their playlists, but actually that could have very sentimental value and it could, you know, go many different ways. So just, yeah, really thinking about the questions you're asking, the research you're doing, in which direction can it go? And then, as I said, how are you prepared to handle that if it does go in a direction that's maybe not the favored route?
Yeah, that's perfect. I really appreciate that. These are really helpful insights and gives us a lot of great practical ways of approaching ethics within research. I think sometimes we might get lost through some of the theory or the bigger, more macro systemic level things that are connected. And it's important to remember like the micro implementable ways that are coming into our day-to-day lives as well. I have our hat trick questions. These are three questions that we ask every guest, and it's just a personal way for us to get to know the humans on the other side. And so my first question for you, Melanie, is what's one thing that you've done in your career that has helped you succeed that you think very few people do?
I don't know if this is what very few people do, but there's two things that come to mind. One thing is ask why and just like keep asking questions. And with that, I think it's just like admitting when you're like, I don't know what's going on. I think it could be really easy for people to, especially in the tech industry, to build this like persona of like, oh, I know everything and I have to know everything or I'm not successful. And I'm like, honestly, if I don't know something, I'm not going to be able to do my job as best as I can if I'm just like making assumptions. So I feel like being humble in that way too is just really important and to keep questioning things, even if it's something that people are really excited about, but maybe your research or even just like your hunch or whatever is like, this doesn't seem so right. Just questioning everything and maybe even questioning why you're questioning it too. It could be like a nice introspective exercise.
I love that.
Yeah. And the other thing is to build relationships with your team. And I think like this also kind of goes hand in hand with like asking why, because if you have strong relationships with your team, then you don't feel embarrassed or ashamed or stupid for like asking for clarification. You know, it's just, it makes work so much more enjoyable when you feel like you can connect with the person and you want to actually hang out with them outside of work too.
Yeah. And builds in that environment for vulnerable question asking and things like you described too, which is so great. My next question is, what is the industry-related book that you have recommended or given the most?
One that I've read that I would recommend is called A More Beautiful Question. So it's funny that you mentioned some things earlier about, you know, critical thinking and like deductive reasoning and all that type of thing, because this book highlights really well that what's really great is to keep asking questions and to build like a really great question. It's just like, it sparks good conversation. It helps you get insights really well in your work if you're a researcher. And I think what's really interesting is that the book talks about how when we're younger, we grow up asking questions all the time. And you know, it's cute, but it can also be annoying. So I think like, as we get older, maybe we think more that it's annoying and we don't want to like disturb people. So we ask questions as a kid a lot. And then I think we get worried about coming off as like stupid or whatever if we keep asking why, like I was saying. And so I think the book goes into the whole history of like why it's important to ask really good questions, why do we stop asking questions, and how society has kind of played a role into like why we don't keep asking questions.
Definitely. That's a great recommendation. My last question for you is, what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
This actually happened last night while I was packing, and I'm just so sick of packing. Like, you know, I've been doing it my whole life or whatever, and it never gets easier, it seems. And when I do things that I don't necessarily want to do, I end up like making song, like I just start singing songs like about the thing that I'm doing and how much I hate it.
That's amazing. You sing your way through it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, oh, this sucks, but how could I make it, I don't know, a bit more fun?
Oh, this has been incredible. I really appreciate you taking the opportunity to share this with us, your experience and expertise in this area, and of course for playing along to get to know you a little bit better. This has been great. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah, me too. It was a lot of fun.
The Optimal Path is hosted by Ash Oliver and brought to you by Maze, a product research platform designed for product teams. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find resources linked in the show notes. If you want to hear more, you can subscribe to The Optimal Path by visiting maze.co/podcast. Thanks for listening, and until next time.